What makes a life a good one? Is it the adventure you have? Or the friends you find along the way? Maybe it's pursuing your passion while striving to protect, defend, and save what you believe in every single day. So, what makes a life a good one? In the Coast Guard, we think it's all of the above and more. But you'll have to find out for yourself. Visit GoCoastGuard.com to learn more.
That's not just the sound of that first sip of Morning Joe. It's the sound of someone shopping for a car on Carvana from the comfort of home.
That's a good blend.
It's time to take it easy, like answering some easy questions to get pre-qualified for a car in minutes.
Talk about starting the morning right.
Just like customizing your terms so your car fits your budget.
Mm-mm-mm.
Visit Carvana.com or download the app to experience car shopping the way it should be. Convenient, comfortable. Ah.
All right, we're going to talk to Tristan Snell here in just one second. But first, I got to talk to you about our Patreon page at BobSeskaShow.com. You might have noticed that most other podcasts only post one show a week or maybe even one show a month. But here, we record three free shows every week in order to keep up with our politics. Actually, make it six shows if you include the after party on Fridays and the Shadow Docket bonus shows on our Patreon page. And since we're not part of a cable news network or a fancy corporation, we rely on your support to keep producing upwards of six shows a week. And the best way to support the Bob Seska Show is to sign up for $5 a month at BobSeskaShow.com. That's pennies per episode and only $60 per year. And it helps us keep up with the fire hose of news every day. Again, that's BobSeskaShow.com or Patreon.com/BobSeskaShow. And now let the cartoons begin.
The Bob Seska Show.
Bob Seska.
Today's Rachel Maddow Show Award for Headline Excellence goes to Bob Seska.
The Bob Seska Show.
From our nation's capital, it is Wednesday, January 31, 2024, and this is the Bob Seska Interview on the Sexy Liberal Podcast Network. Hi, I'm Bob.
Hello, Bob.
Hi, day 1106 of the Biden-Harris administration, 279 days until the 24 presidential election. You find me on Threads and Instagram at TheBobSeska, Twitter, BobSeska_go, and our Patreon page is BobSeskaShow.com. Well, the great Tristan Snell is here today to talk about his brand new book, Taking Down Trump, 12 Rules for Prosecuting Donald Trump, by someone who did it successfully. It's out right now. I got a link in the description, of course. Tristan's one of the New York prosecutors who helped take down Trump University. Plus, you probably know him from MSNBC, CNN, and The Stephanie Miller Show. We recorded today's show, by the way, while waiting for an announcement from Judge Engoron in Trump's civil fraud trial. So chances are you're hearing this podcast after the judgment has been handed down. But Tristan also provides some preemptive analysis that will shed some light on what's next for Trump and his finances. So you should be listening to this one. Meantime, don't forget to support this podcast by subscribing to us on Patreon, BobSeskaShow.com. Okay, this is me and author Tristan Snell.
More fun, more music, the Bob Seska Show.
We're all waiting for Judge Engoron today. So
the longer
we delay, the better off I think we're going to be. I've been suffering from this thing, Tristan. Every time I do a show, as soon as I'm finished recording, that's when all the breaking news lands. Like seconds after I'm done recording a show. And it's driving me crazy.
That's of course how it goes. Well, I mean, part of it with the courts, though, is that they like we're not going to get Engoron until after four.
Okay.
I bet you anything.
Damn it.
Having worked for a federal judge for a year, I can tell you that the key is you want, if you have a deadline in mind, you're going to go all the way up to the end. That's what every lawyer will always do. And then it has to be five because otherwise the clerk's office downstairs won't be able to actually publish it.
Yeah.
And you need to get there before they go home for the day. So that's why all the court things often come out at five.
So do you think it's going to be today?
Oh, yeah. I doubt he would have gone there and said, look, he could blow his own deadline and say, oh, shoot, we didn't get it. But but if they make a public commitment to do something by a certain time, they usually hit that.
OK. Do you have any predictions about what Trump might have to pay?
I think it's going to be at least $200 million, and it could be all the way up to the $370 or more. I don't think he's going to go lower than that. That's my bet. I think it's going to be a bit very big number.
Do you think Judge Engoron is someone who would add money just because of Donald Trump's behavior in the courtroom?
He could, but I think he might be a little bit wary of doing so because of the sensitivity of this. I do think it's possible that he could go higher.
Yeah.
But I think that there's a difference between the seal of approval of a jury doing it, mm-hmm. where it's like, okay, these are random citizens who are serving, as opposed to a judge who already had a very bright spotlight shone on him. If I were Engoron, I would not go a penny over 370.
I see.
Just because I don't want to create something that then makes more problems on appeal.
I think
judges hate getting overturned. That's like the thing they hate the most. So I just don't think he's going to do anything that will put more of a target on him.
Do you see any reason, and obviously you don't have any of the facts that would be handed down today in hand, but do you see any reason why something like this would be overturned on appeal? I mean, is there any real possibility of that happening?
So there is for a part of this. So I think we need to break apart the three different things that are going on here. One is the question of, is he liable for fraud? Mm-hmm. I think that's going to stick.
Okay.
Number two is, if he's liable, how much does he have to pay in disgorgement and restitution to the state? And that number could go down on appeal. It sometimes does on appeals, just in the same way that the E. Jean Carroll number might go down on appeal. But it'll go, but in those cases, I don't see it going down by 90%. I see it going down by 20%.
Okay.
So then there's the third question, which I think is the much more interesting one and is going to really draw a lot of the attention on appeal, is going to be Engoron's determination that the corporation licenses should be canceled and the corporations should be put, they're LLCs, but that these corporate entities should be placed into receivership, that the corporate charters should be canceled. And then what would happen is a court-appointed third-party receiver, similar to in a bankruptcy case, would then be controlling those entities, would liquidate them. And then if there's anything, the money would first go to creditors.
Mm-hmm.
And if there's anything left over, it would get distributed to Trump. It's not like he would not get the proceeds.
Yeah.
But the problem is, I think a lot of those properties are so deeply in hock that I don't know. I think he's underwater on a number of them. I think a lot of that money would then go, or all of it in some instances, would go to the various banks that lent him the money. And he could end up losing control of one of these buildings and getting $0 for it. Because it's actually underwater. And that is a penalty that is provided for in the statute here, this statutory fraud provision under New York law, which is called Executive Law 6312.
Mm-hmm.
The question is going to be, is it merited in this case? The law provides that it has to be repeated and persistent fraud and illegality. I think it very much that Trump's misconduct, that the Trump organization's misconduct, and that of their various subsidiaries very much fits the bill. But that's going to be the big issue, in my view, on appeal. Because if he loses control of those entities, that's how he's able to keep this house of cards up, is that he's generating revenue from these buildings, particularly the ones in New York. I mean, most of his golf courses have been money losers always. Some of these buildings in New York at least generate revenue that he then can use to service the debt and pay for other things like all of his legal fees. Although now he's really looks like he's grabbing all of that money from his political donors.
Yeah,
it's very clear. The signs are very clear to me as sort of a longtime, investigator and watcher of these situations with him.
Hmm.
I believe that he is facing a liquidity crisis.
Yeah.
And I think that I think that these cases in New York last week and this week are going to push him over the edge.
Yeah, right. I mean, how does he pay without being as liquid as he says that he is? Which, believe his deposition, he said $400 million in cash that he had. But who the hell knows?
No.
He loves to exaggerate, doesn't he?
He loves to exaggerate. Yes, again, bear in mind, most people probably know roughly the square footage of their house or their apartment. Donald Trump exaggerated the size of his apartment by three times, by 300%. It was a 10,000 square foot condo. By the way, wouldn't that be nice? That's lovely for him. Right. But he said not to be satisfied with that, which it would be palatial pretty much anywhere. It's absolutely titanically large by Manhattan standards. But no. Because I think he wanted to be able to brag that he had one of the largest residences in New York, if not the largest, he exaggerated the size, and he also wanted to get these preferential loan deals.
Yeah.
He exaggerated the size of his unit by 3x and said it was 30,000 square feet. So yeah, $400 million that he's liquid, I don't buy it.
Right.
Otherwise, why did he have to take $50 million worth of political donations last year to pay for his legal fees? Otherwise, why did he take $40 million out of the Trump Organization in violation of a court order last year, where he wasn't supposed to touch those assets, to pay off a $29 million tax bill and to pay the money that he owes E. Jean Carroll from last year's case? So I don't think he's liquid. And I think this is going to make things immeasurably worse. He's going to be in really deep trouble, I think.
What happens when you lie like that under oath? I mean, obviously, you know, I would imagine it's a number that can be quantified through documents. Does it even matter? I mean, are we so deep into the weeds by going there that it doesn't even matter that he may have lied about his liquid assets?
You know, that's a good point. That he actually could, in theory, be investigated for perjury.
Yeah.
Would anybody bother to do that? I don't know. I mean, the thing is, like, I think that the attitude that prosecutors would probably take to that one, or at least it would be if it were me making the decision, is let's just kind of put that in a drawer and forget about it right now.
Right.
You know, and keep track of the statute of limitations on it, but just kind of table that one for now.
Mm-hmm.
Put a pin in it. Because we've got bigger fish to fry. Like, let's go see about these, you know, conspiracy to topple the government and Espionage Act.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. And Espionage Act violations before we worry about perjury.
Mm-hmm.
Not that that's anything to sneeze at, but I would probably just like, you know, put that one away for now.
Yeah. There's so many more things that you can prosecute that would be more effective, right? In terms of a result than going after this one little thing that I think we're all seeing now based on his April deposition. But one of the comments I'm getting a lot, Tristan, is that Trump is going to refuse to pay, whether it's the E. Jean Carroll judgment or whether it's the fines related to what will hopefully happen this afternoon. What are the mechanisms in New York State, for example, that will force him to pay these things one way or another, be it fines or civil judgments?
So with any judgment, then you can go back to court to enforce the judgment.
Yeah.
And then you basically turn the judgment into a court order.
Mm-hmm.
And then that has other ramifications. There's lots of ways that the state or Carroll would be able to get at Trump. They'd be able to place liens on the properties. But they would get paid ahead of anybody else if the property ends up getting sold. But they also can put liens on bank checking accounts and on income. So basically, if Trump wants to keep on collecting rent on tenants in Trump Tower, you can go basically put a lien on the revenue stream there and actually get at it. So the bank will comply. And there's no bank around that he can use that would then not want to comply with a court order from the state of New York, because every bank on the planet, you know, obviously not every bank, there's banks in places that don't care whether or not they have a branch in New York, but no large bank can get away with not having a presence in New York.
Yeah.
So there are plenty of ways that you would be able to get at money for him. So even if he were to refuse to pay, one thing that we need to note for everybody listening is that these cases may end up having a long tail of appeal coming up, where it may be a year or more before we find out both the E. Jean Carroll case and the New York AG case. It may take a while for these things to go up on appeal. You can't really say that either one of those cases has some sort of important public interest, like the election cases do, where, you know, we're seeing DC Circuit and SCOTUS expedite their decision making around the immunity issue in the DC January 6th case. You know, that's because of the public interest involved in kind of getting to the bottom of that. And we're seeing that DOJ has successfully lit a fire under those various judges, although maybe it's not hot enough. I'd love to see the move even faster. But I think that when it comes to the one thing I'd love to see, and I'd love to see this argument get made in these New York cases, both Carroll and the New York AG case, they should be arguing that Trump could move assets around to evade judgment.
Yeah.
And as proof of that, they could point to his improper and in violation of court order transfer of money out of the Trump Organization last year, the $40 million I was alluding to. I would be using that as an example of saying, hey, if he's gonna move assets around and evade the court ordered monitor, and now he's also under investigation for potentially falsifying or otherwise providing incorrect information to the court ordered monitor.
Yeah.
And that's separately being investigated here. Couldn't it be possible that he's going to find some way to creatively get rid of some of the assets that would be used to pay these judgments, and thereby the appeals should be expedited to make it less likely that he can engage in these shenanigans? If I were the AG's office, for example, I would definitely be wanting to make that argument. I don't know if it'll fly, and we may be stuck with sort of the normal speed of an appeal process, which is to say, not speed. Appeals processes usually take a while. And I think that, of course, they're going to be really being extra careful when it comes to these cases because they don't want to mess them up. So, you know, get ready, everybody. It may be a little bit anticlimactic. We're going to get these big judgment numbers, but then they're going to go up on appeal, and we may not hear a whole lot about those cases for the rest of this year. Not to rain on people's parades, but I think we need to be prepared for that.
So, is in the AG James case, the Judge Engoron case, is there still that mechanism for if you want to appeal the pay to play mechanism that we're seeing in place for the E. Jean Carroll case? Does that also apply to the whatever judgment is handed down today?
Yes. So we would be looking at some kind of bond situation in all likelihood there. And then we'll have to see how that actually gets done in practice. But it's possible that we're gonna that Trump is going to have to put up some money in order to basically keep that judgment in place to be able to satisfy that requirement pending appeal, and just even having to come up with that money alone, which it could be somewhere in the neighborhood of 15 to 18 million. That could also be onerous. This is going to get interesting. Just satisfying that court requirement on a $83 million jury verdict, that's going to be problematic. And then he may have to do it again on a number that I expect from I'm expecting Judge Engoron to come up with a number that'll probably be somewhere between $200 million and the $370 million that the AG's office is asking for.
Right, right.
And so that'll be yet another number that Trump then needs to come up with at least part of in order to get it into the appeal process.
Okay. So also on Twitter, you asked whether Trump is illegally using campaign money to pay his legal bills. And we know for a fact that he's using super PAC money, right? And is that in and of itself legal? I mean, what are the guardrails around doing something like this?
You know, with the caveat that I'm not, you know, I posted as a question in part because I was kind of hoping, and I need to go look at the comments again.
Oh, okay,
to see if
I see. All
typed
right.
up. I really was meaning it as a bit of a question for legal Twitter, but also for journalists.
Yeah, yeah.
Because I'm not an election lawyer. That's a very specialized area of law.
I see. Okay.
But the folks who do it really well will hopefully be able to chime in on this. It is a question that I think at least we need to hear commentary on whether or not people, experts think that is. And I do believe that that we need to be looking into, there need to be journalists looking into this. And I think that even if some of these monies are coming from the super PAC, are there other monies that are coming from other campaign pots of money? We need to, those questions at least need to be asked. And I don't really feel like they're getting paid nearly enough attention. Mm-hmm. And I think that the things that he's, you know, paying for are way beyond the pale of what a candidate should be able to pay in terms of covering their own personal expenses.
I see.
It's one thing to say, oh, you had to go through a legitimate recount process post-election, and those are legal fees that you incur, and that some kind of campaign-related pot of money can be used to pay for those legal expenses. It's another thing entirely to say, oh, my personal businesses are getting investigated for fraud.
Yeah.
No, that's not something you can use your campaign dollars on.
Right.
I raped a woman and then defamed her, and now I'm on trial for that. No, you cannot use your campaign money for that. I conspired with a number of other people to try to overturn the election when I knew that there had not been election fraud. You know, he's going to argue that that's okay, that that somehow is a campaign-related political legal expense that thereby he gets to use campaign dollars on. And I think there's a very good argument that that's not true. I really think that this merits at least journalistic investigation, if not legal investigation.
And I'm so glad you're here today, Tristan, not only because we're awaiting Judge Engoron's decision here, but we also learned today that Trump is shopping around for representation, at least if you believe what he writes on Truth Central, I think he calls it, that he's looking for representation in his appeal of the E. Jean Carroll defamation judgment. Does this mean Alina Habba was fired, or is it customary to secure a new counsel for appeals like that? Is that something that people normally
do? It could be a little of column A and a little of column B.
Okay.
Because it is customary that you would get a separate appellate counsel. That's actually very standard. So even if you win a trial, which they most decidedly did not, but even if you win a trial, you're then going to be, you know, needing specialized appellate counsel, probably. It's usually a very particular thing. That's a different skill set, and usually a different lawyer, and sometimes even a different law firm.
Yeah.
from whoever did the trial. The appellate's going to be a different set of folks. Mm-hmm. However, let us be clear here. And I talk about Habba a good bit in my book, and then I think recent events have borne out some of the things that I talk about in the book.
Yeah.
You know, there's a whole chapter devoted to sort of the clown car effect of Trump and the lawyers coming out and coming up with a bunch of diversions and various entertainments and counterattacks and whatnot, and that they're going to just flood the zone with a bunch of garbage, and you need to not pay attention to most of the things they put out there and focus on the signal, not the noise, is how I put it in the book.
Right.
That's one of the rules in the book. And I think it's well advised for any lawyers going up against Trump. But Habba has brought quite the clown car effect with a lot of these things. But the other thing that I say in the book is what you need to do if you're the opposing lawyers with going up against somebody like Habba is wait. Just wait. Because Trump has gotten these people that are more there for spewing vitriol and coming up with a lot of, like, you know, shiny object diversionary tactics. Wait for those lawyers who often are not very good lawyers to make a mistake. And that's what happened here.
Yeah.
So Habba, you know, failed to get this case in front of a jury. All she had to do was check off a box on a form. She either did it deliberately or it was an oversight. Yeah. But they needed to get that case in front of a jury, and they failed to do it. Mm-hmm. And instead, Judge Engoron heard the case in a bench trial. Trump and Habba have been running around being like, oh, we didn't get a jury. We didn't get a jury. It was not denied them. They literally just needed to check off a box on a form, and they failed to do so. If your passport is too slow to arrive when you get your passport, or you're renewing your driver's license because you didn't check the box off on the form to then pay $20 extra and get your ID delivered to you faster, do you run around screaming, they didn't get me my ID, my civil rights are being violated? Yeah. No, dumb, you didn't check off the box on the goddamn form. So that's what's happened here, but, you know, at a, obviously a higher level of abstraction, and sort of a better way to put it is it's obviously more meaningful than not getting your ID on time. but it's the same principle. It's like, look, you didn't check off the box. The government had a form. It's very simple. Everybody can read it. And it's just like, boop. Oh, look, I checked off the box and now we got a jury. It was that simple and they blew it. And there's a lot of other things too that I could get into, but you know, I'd say one more thing is that Haba and then the degree to which she showed a lack of respect for Judge Kaplan in that E. Jean Carroll case recently, plus the fact that they then, even though the judge had specifically said, we are not relitigating whether there was an assault and whether there was defamation, that liability was already decided and in the first case, and it's carrying over to case number two. Do not touch that. What did Haba and Trump do? They went there. They got Trump on the stand and they tried to start relitigating the issue. And Judge Kaplan, you know, admonished them, told the jury to disregard, blah, blah, blah. In my view, the things that Haba did in that case probably tacked on an additional $30 million or more to Trump's tab. Like, she lost him a whole bunch of money through her antics and lack of preparation and lack of decorum. And just lack of any common sense, let alone good lawyering. Like, honestly, I think that any of us that aren't lawyers being plunked into a courtroom like that would at least have the presence of mind to stand and address the judge respectfully when needing to speak. And she didn't do that. It's just like, just boggles the mind. Yeah. But like, and it wasn't the judge that decided it, but then that jury watching all of this, what it showed was a total lack of respect and, key here, a total lack of contrition. Right. There was not a single shred of contrition or anything at all exhibiting some sense of shame or anything from Trump. And the jury threw the book at him, and Haba deserves a lot of the blame there. So even if she wasn't fired here because she would just get swapped out for an appellate lawyer at this point anyway, she should be. She certainly deserves to be fired. By the way, she already got benched on all of these cases once about a year ago, and then she got brought back in because Trump does this all the time. He fires a lawyer or benches them and then suddenly brings them back later because he's desperate and fickle and narcissistic and thinks that his latest idea was his greatest one. And then he puts them back in after he kicked them out.
Yeah. In fact, is this something that you've noticed in your experiences too? Like,
oh yes.
I'm sure you've noticed that Trump often puppeteers his lawyers. He micromanages them to death.
Very much so.
And then he's like, why is everything going sideways? He doesn't understand why things are going badly for him.
Yeah. It's just like, gosh, whoever's masterminding this legal case must really suck at their job.
Exactly.
You know,
right.
And it's just like, it's you. Yeah. You're the problem.
Right.
Like, you're the one messing all of this up.
Yeah.
You know, like, come on. Like, so one of the things I talk about this a good bit in the book also is that this happened as I was writing the book last year, is that I was going back and looking at some of the briefs in the Trump University case that I worked on, where we got the briefs from opposing counsel. And here's the thing. If you've ever looked at a legal brief, the argument from a lawyer, it usually is, it's often very tough reading, in part because every sentence or two, there's a whole string of citations. You're either citing to court cases or you're citing to evidence, to exhibits.
Yeah.
And it's constantly interrupting the flow. Lawyers are used to it, but if you're not a lawyer or like a legal journalist or something, like, it's very tough sledding to read a legal brief. But the point is that you're supposed to be bringing receipts for everything you say. Everything you say, you're supposed to be saying what supports that position. Everything. Like, that's the point.
Yeah.
That's what legal briefs are. That's what they do. You're not supposed to just, like, say things. They're supposed to be things that are supported by the law or the facts. Mm-hmm. Okay. Simple, really, at the end of the day, even though it looks like gobbledygook on a page. It's not pretty, but it's effective. And that's how law works. Okay. Then you get Trump's legal briefs and his lawyers, and they'll go pages and pages and pages and pages of these briefs. And they're doing it today too, where they don't cite a single case and they don't cite a single piece of evidence. It's just a rant for like 5, 6, 10 pages in a row before they ever get around to being like, oh yeah, by the way, it's the blah, blah, blah case. And it's not like an oversight. It's because there is no support for what he's saying.
Yeah.
It's just an unhinged speech. Right. And then you read them. And I went back and read these from like 2013 from Trump's lawyer at the time who went up against us in the Trump University matter. Mm-hmm. And it's like, huh, this reads a lot like a Truth Social rant.
Exactly.
Like a lot.
Yeah.
Like a lot, a lot. Yeah. And it's like I was rereading them 10 years later and I'm like, I think Trump really was probably the one who came up with all of this. Mm-hmm. And he just gets a lawyer to put it in for him.
Right.
I think that's half of what happens with his lawyers. I think he gets, and he doesn't, you know, he famously, infamously doesn't use computers and texting and whatnot. Although, fun side note, except for probably Twitter DMs, and I think it may end up being the thing that completely, the bombshell thing that's going to make the Nixon tapes look like a play date for kindergartners I think by the end of this year, we may be talking about one of the most important things maybe ever in American history being Trump's DMs.
Yes.
So we'll get back to that later.
Right.
I think though that for a guy who doesn't use computers and whatnot, what is he doing? He's probably getting on the phone and talking to one of these lawyers, to Haba or to one of these people from 10 years ago, whoever it was. Mm-hmm. And he just is going on and on and on and just ranting and ranting and ranting. And then that lawyer is like trying to get down all the notes and then recreate Trump's rant, but inside the structure of a legal brief. But it basically is just an unhinged rant.
Yeah.
And I think that's probably a lot of what he's doing. And it's just like, yeah, he must be just sitting there thinking to himself, whoever's managing these lawyers is doing a terrible, terrible job. And it's like, yep, I think there's a lot of mirrors in Mar-a-Lago. Some of them might be obscured by towering boxes of classified records that we still don't know about in some untold bathroom of that place. Mm-hmm. But he needs to go find a mirror so he can look at who's managing his legal matters for him.
It's incredible. Man.
But yeah.
Okay. Short break, back with more Tristan Snell right after these words.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
You can't always get a clean you can feel good about inside and out unless you're using Bubble Genius bath and body products. See, Bubble Genius is a woman-owned small business proudly creating our vegan-friendly products in America and supporting other U.S. businesses by buying our ingredients and supplies from them as often as possible. Plus, you'll be hard-pressed to find packaging as recyclable as ours. Visit BubbleGenius.com and check out our cause-related items too, like our global warming soap and a lot more. We donate our proceeds for those items to worthy causes, like organizations combating climate change and mountaintop removal mining. Good stuff like that. We also send our products to the troops overseas through our Buy a Soldier a Shower campaign. Because the least we can do is keep them smiling and smelling great, right? So visit BubbleGenius.com and feel good and clean. Bubble Genius, doing our part to make the world a better place, one bathtub at a time. That's BubbleGenius.com.
Seska. All-time favorites all day long.
And just in the context of your book, I don't want to spoil all the different rules because I want people to pick up the book because it's so good. But rule number 5 is one that I found really intriguing, especially in this context. It's one we talk about a lot. Trump screws over his vendors and business partners. why do people still do business with him? It's staggering to me that people still try to worm their way. I mean, why do lawyers continue to represent literally the worst client in the world? What do they think is going to happen? Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, he really is, because he just, even if you agree with his politics, which let's just put that aside, whatever, even if you agree with him on some policy grounds or what, he's the worst lawyer in the world because he will not pay you.
Yes.
And you're going to get your reputation shredded because he's completely shameless and awful and so forth. So it's just like, it's just a terrible 1-2 punch. You're going to get your reputation shredded. You're not even going to make any money off of it. Yeah, I think there's enough. The part of the kicker for him is that I do think he's been running out of lawyers to work with him.
Yeah,
it's been true. Like we hear about these new cases come up, and then he's got to do a lot of extra work to get lawyers who will represent him. Mm-hmm. I think what one of the cases I think it was the Georgia case. Like it was sort of like a question mark whether or not he was going to have anybody be there to be there for his arraignment.
Yes, I remember.
Like he was really struggling to find a Georgia defense attorney that would take him on. Now, part of it, of course, though, was that a lot of other defense lawyers in Georgia had gone the safer route of representing one of Trump's co-defendants. Mm-hmm. And arguably, you can't really, it's tough to then represent more than one defendant in a case like that because their interests diverge. They all have a strong interest in throwing the other co-defendants under the bus. But at any rate, yeah, why do people still want to work with him? I think there's enough people that are either still starstruck by him.
Yeah.
Or that are desperate enough to do it as a gambit to raise their profile, where they just know that like the Trump's ability to shine a spotlight onto himself is so big that like it's going to then encompass the lawyer as well. And then suddenly it's going to take somebody like nobody knew who Alina Haba was.
Yep.
Before all of this, you know, she had, as we all know, worked as an in-house counsel for a parking garage company, among other things. She then did have this firm that she had founded or co-founded out in New Jersey, out in Bedminster, where Trump has one of his golf clubs and where he spends like half the year. And then supposedly the deal is that she became a member of the club and then like basically started like, you know, figuring out when he was going to be there and trying to chat him up and managed to sort of work her way into his inner circle.
Yeah.
And now everybody knows who she is. And I guess she's operating on the principle that there's no such thing as bad publicity, but I don't know that that's necessarily true. And I bet you that he's not paying her. I don't know that for sure, but that's just a hunch.
Yeah.
You know, other people have managed to put their foot down and say, I need to get paid up front, including Chris Keist.
Yeah, I remember.
You know, he supposedly managed to negotiate $2 million up front, but it may be that his fees have now climbed in excess of that, and he's not going to see that. You know, we've seen it in other things, too. Rudy Giuliani, in declaring bankruptcy, has basically pointed to Trump as effectively one of his deadbeat, payables that needs to pay up, and that Trump owes him millions of dollars. Which also could have the hilarious effect of then pulling Trump in as a third party that has to answer to things in the bankruptcy.
Yeah.
This is going to get extremely fun.
Mm-hmm.
So, because what happens there is that then the trustee for the bankruptcy estate then goes to those deadbeat payables and says, pay up because the bankruptcy estate needs cash.
Yeah.
So, somebody else, a bankruptcy trustee, may be going and shaking down Trump for Rudy's money.
Wow.
You know, fun things like that. But as I put in the book, you know, the key there is that it's not only that these people are out there, but it's also that you should be striking up alliances with them because they can potentially break open your case. I'm sure the authorities have been doing so with regard to Rudy. And, you know, we don't know yet about what's going on with Rudy in some of these cases, but we don't, you know, there has not been a breakthrough that we know of. You know, we know that there was at least flirtation with a cooperation deal with DOJ. There was a proffer session or what's called sort of queen for a day immunity. He sat down with them, spilled some beans, got immunity for anything he spilled that day. And that's usually a prelude to cutting some kind of plea and cooperation deal, or it often is. And in this case, it didn't. We don't know. It could have happened.
Yeah.
But in the Trump University case, as I described, it is in fact how we got one of the main vendors who we needed to get a hold of had a pile of transcripts. There were tapes of the Trump University sessions, and they had been transcribed. And we felt that they would corroborate our victims' accounts to basically say, okay, they're like, when the students got to these classes, they were being told all these lies and all these frauds. Mm-hmm. And we were able to, once I brought up, hey, did you ever get paid that last bill of yours? Because I saw an email exchange. It looks like you were owed about 14 grand. Did you ever get that paid? And the guy didn't really want to cooperate until I brought that up. Wow. And then it's like, and then it was, you know, we got what we needed out of him. And that was really like the turning point in the investigation. After that, we had all the evidence we needed. The case was good before that. After that, it was like, this is extremely solid. Like, yeah, we really have this very well-constructed case. So yeah, it's a mystery to me. I mean, I can speculate as to some reasons why people keep working with him as I did, but you know, it sure as hell isn't a smart thing to do.
Right,
and
right.
A lot of people have ruined their lives working with him.
Absolutely.
And the number of small businesses that he has screwed over. I'm actually going to be writing and doing videos about this more in the weeks to come, because I think it's something that needs to get out there again, because people have forgotten about it.
Mm-hmm.
But he has ruined so many lives. And for folks that were small business owners, you know, mom and pop businesses, and you know, for him to run around claiming that he's somehow the champion of the sort of Main Street America and the American dream, it's like he's anything but. He's been an absolute scourge to, you know, hundreds, thousands of small business owners and aspiring entrepreneurs. All of the Trump University students were all there to learn about real estate.
Yeah.
They were all budding. They were all aspiring entrepreneurs. They wanted to be like Trump.
Mm-hmm.
and they were his super fans, and he stuck the knife in and took their money.
Yeah, there are scores of subcontractors and contractors in Atlantic City that were left.
Exactly. That's one of the biggest places. High and dry.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. And yeah, and when he shuts down a business rather than pay off the bills before he shuts it down, he just shuts it down. And even though the Trump organization supposedly has all this money, he won't stand behind shutting down the business and paying these people, even when the business isn't getting shut down. As soon as he has a small business or even a larger business or a lawyer or whomever on the other side that he thinks he can abuse by basically saying, oh yeah, I'll pay you later. Oh yeah, I'll pay you later. And then it never comes.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he did it to Michael Cohen too.
Cohen
describes it in great detail in his books. Trump and Cohen got a bunch of his money finally last year, having sued Trump and then took it to a settlement right before trial last year, and won what I think we can imagine was probably a good settlement, because Cohen knows that the key is you just have to keep pushing. He's gonna give you the runaround. He's going to make it difficult for you, but if you keep pushing, eventually you will beat him. You just need to keep pushing.
Yeah. Rule number two in your book, Tristan, is something I actually hadn't heard before, that Trump will try to buy the prosecutors. This kind of sent a chill down my spine. Talk about that for a second. I mean, has he been successful in that enterprise before? And is there any evidence that he may be doing it now?
He's definitely been successful at it before, where he's really co-opted a lot of these prosecutors with suspiciously timed campaign donations or promise of future support in an upcoming campaign. You know, he did it with Greg Abbott, who mysteriously dropped an investigation into Trump University when he was the Texas AG.
Wow.
Texas had opened an investigation, and then all of a sudden it evaporated. And then not long after that, when Abbott ran for governor of Texas the first time, Trump ended up supporting Abbott, even though Trump has no business interests in Texas. And at that point he was not in politics himself. You know, why was he running around donating to Greg Abbott in a state where he has no properties?
Yeah.
I wonder. And there's a whole bunch of other examples that I cite in the book, and I believe that it's one of the big ways that he evaded justice for over 40 years. From really about like 1973 to 2013, when we finally brought our Trump University case against him, is he actually successfully doing these kind of things today? And by the way, another one of the cases that I point to in the book is not just about Trump, but about Don Jr. and Ivanka. So people are going to want to thumb to that section of the book about how daddy came in with his lawyers and helped make a boo-boo go away. Donnie and Vanky almost ended up going to jail. They were going to get indicted by the Manhattan DA until Dada intervened. So that makes for some fun reading also.
Yeah.
And these are known things. I just tried to put them all together.
Right.
These were things that have been out there for a long time. They've been reported on forever, but I wanted to try to put them in context and put them in a structure.
Yeah. Yeah.
So people can see the pattern for themselves and draw their own conclusions. Is he doing that now? I think he might be trying, but he's failing at it. And that's exactly why the prosecutors are finally circling in on him.
Mm-hmm.
Because people like Tish James or Fonnie Willis, they're not buying it. He's not going to get them to stop.
No.
He's not managing to promise support for them. And now he's like really like attacking them all the time. The battle has been joined. It's too far gone for that. So, you know, and same with Alvin Bragg, the Manhattan DA. Like these folks have joined the battle. They did not let themselves get co-opted or sort of charmed by the promise of donations or anything like that, or threatened by the threat of counterattacks. They went and did it. And then Jack Smith, no. Mr. I prosecute war crimes in The Hague. Do you think that guy's going to be scared off or
not
co-opted?
No,
he's not going to be. Mm-mm. So I don't think that, that part of Trump's playbook is now dead. He's not getting anywhere with it anymore. And it's part of why he's losing.
Yeah. Which makes me smile and smile. Tristan, do you have any thoughts about why the DC circuit is taking longer than usual on the immunity question?
Because they're going to write an opinion that was longer than my book.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, that's what I keep thinking about. This has to pass scrutiny with the Supreme Court as well.
It's going to be like 200 pages long. It's going to be, we're going to get this like doorstop of an opinion that then we're all going to have to read. I'm sure it's going to be really good. I like the DC circuit is, as a lot of people know, it is second only to SCOTUS as sort of like, and really today it's probably better than SCOTUS as being the home of a lot of our most accomplished judges. It's extremely prestigious to get on the DC circuit. It's a very high bar. Why? Because they're often called upon to decide these kind of big, weighty constitutional questions or big, complicated questions of federal law that really make a big difference to how regulations and laws are interpreted throughout the country. When people sue the government, it's often brought in Washington and then it goes up to the DC circuit. So you gotta be really good to make it onto the DC circuit. These folks are gonna do a great job. And it also means the clerks that work for those judges are also superb.
Yeah.
Some of the very top, sort of young legal folks in the country. This is gonna be a great opinion. It's also very, I think they're really working on it and making it as perfect as they can get it.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't blame them. But yeah, I'd like to, it'd be great if that came down to, watch it all hit together. Watch all of it happen at like 4:57 today.
Right.
And all of a sudden we're like, trying to read all this stuff. That's the way these things go.
Yeah. So is part of the goal to make sure that maybe the Supreme Court doesn't take it up? That their ruling stands, that the DC circuit's ruling stands. So they're trying to cover all their bases is essentially what we're saying here.
It's possible. I mean, I think they would certainly like that, but it's also, look, it's their chance to, if you're one of those judges, if you're one of those law clerks, you want to make a, this is a big chance to weigh in on a major constitutional issue and something that's going to go down in history. If you're thinking like that, you're gonna bring your A game, and you're probably gonna spend the extra time to make it as great as you can make it.
Mm.
So now, will it be enough to make SCOTUS not, do its own song and dance? I don't know about that. But even if that's true, you still want your opinion to be there and to be as good as you can make it.
Yeah.
Yeah, and they want to make it airtight because it's a matter of critical national importance. sentence.
Yeah.
So, you know, it really, there's few that are more important. I mean, effectively, you're making a determination as to whether or not equal justice under law, which is what's inscribed on the front of the Supreme Court,
yep,
is still a thing. Is that still a thing? Or are we kind of just giving up on it after 250 years?
Mm-hmm.
I guess we'll see.
So one area where I'm not as hopeful, which is the question about the 14th Amendment Section 3 as it stands before the Supreme Court, where do you think that's going to land?
I think they're going to punt and not really take it on directly. I might be wrong about this. I think what they're going to do is they're going to appellate. Courts always have the option, or not always, but they sometimes and maybe often have the option of saying, you know, we need more of a factual record down below, or we need this to be worked up a bit more at the trial court level. We're gonna send it back down for further proceedings. And I think that maybe what they do here is to say that the factual record about whether or not January 6th was an insurrection and whether or not Trump engaged in it for purposes of the 14th Amendment Section 3 is not sufficiently well developed. Try again, Colorado. I think that may be what they do, and that basically lets them be like, do, we're not going to touch this right now, and we're hoping that maybe it doesn't come back, and we don't really want to deal with this because it's like, it's radioactive.
Okay.
I don't know, but I think that, like, I think folks like Roberts are like extremely keen to like avoid pulling the court into any other political issues right now because of the absolute dumpster fire that the court has turned into of late, with all the ethics problems and they're sort of going rogue on overturning Roe, all sorts of things. And I think that there's going to be at least some thought given by, I think, a number of the judges to just be like, can we not deal with this? Can we maybe just kick it back and go do something else?
Yeah.
I might be wrong, but that's, I feel like that's a very likely outcome.
Okay.
But we'll see.
Are you feeling confident about the outcome of the November election? Where are you on that?
I feel somewhat confident about it. I guess it depends on the day. I mean, I think we're going to end up in a position where by the fall, Trump has been convicted and sentenced in the federal January 6th case, but is still a candidate for the presidency as the Republican nominee.
Mm-hmm.
I think we are just in for an absolute train wreck this fall.
Yeah.
And I don't know that, now. I think that given that, if you look at the poll numbers, There's a significant number of folks who, if you ask people right now, do you think there's evidence that Trump committed these crimes? It's basically averages out to around like 53-54% of people seem convinced, that there was some illegality here. There were crimes committed. But if you ask people, well, let's assume there is a jury verdict and a conviction, do you still think Trump, you know, should be standing for president? And the answer suddenly ticks up to like 60% saying no.
Yeah.
So I think that gives you a preview of what could happen. I don't think it's going to mean that Trump loses 60-40 or whatever, but I do think it indicates that there is a slice of the electorate that is potentially Trump supporting. But if Trump gets convicted, and I think especially if we see it as being fair, if we see compelling testimony from witnesses, that's going to be, very compelling for people.
The must-read book is called Taking Down Trump, 12 Rules for Prosecuting Donald Trump by Someone Who Did It Successfully, out right now. I got a link in the description, of course, for that. Where can people follow you on social media, Tristan?
I am at Tristan Snell on most platforms like Twitter and Instagram and Threads, and then I'm Tristan Snell 212 on TikTok, and then you can find out more about the book at takingdowntrump.com.
Outstanding. Thanks so much, my friend. We'll talk to you again next time.
Thank you. Take care.
Bye-bye.
She said, have you ever been to New York, Texas? I'm not sure anybody really has. See, Mama always said that God would bless us if we're grateful for what it is we have. Headed straight into the heart of nowhere, Coffee City 20 miles. miles behind. 9 weeks now and she's already shown. I'm not sure what it is we hope to find, but I know.
Bless the wayward runners of the road. Bye.